I don't know how Dub did such a wonderful job last night after the abuse that he received. I think Terry brings preacher abuse to a whole new level. But anyway, I appreciate very much what Cliff had to say. And I do have to comment real quickly, not to use too much of my time, but you know, everybody talks about being this native Texan with such great pride. Folks, where you were born, you had nothing to do with, okay? I could not help it that I was born in San Francisco. That's not my fault, okay? I am a free moral agent. When I realized what had happened and where I was, I hurried down here as quickly as possible to get with God's people. Anyway. I knew this lecture series was going to be a challenge, considering some of the topics and some of the information that was going to be covered in this series. I knew that my lesson was going to be a real challenge covering Exodus 20, what was it I had? Yes, 21 and 22. And the reason is it doesn't accord nicely with your introduction, your 3 points, and your conclusion, all thematic, all running together with a nice singular point that most congregations forget by the time they hit the back door. This is going to be tough. There are all kinds of things that we can look at in these two particular chapters, and that doesn't even cover the entire book, which I appreciate so much, the choice of this book in this lecture, because as has been said, and I will echo consistently and constantly throughout this lesson, we don't study the Old Testament enough. If we were to study it with sincerity and with some knowledge and some background and understand its context, I can guarantee you sincere Christians would not even think about some of the variations that are going on right now, some of the adaptations to culture that we see today. And that's what you look at when you see here right after the Decalogue, this statement as he begins in chapter 21 of the uniqueness that you see in Israel. Now, his purpose here is to show them they're going to be a different kind of people. And you can see each of the things that he teaches them that they are going to do. This is going to make you different amongst the people that you live with. And I'm fully certain that there were a lot of things they didn't understand fully, but they were expected to do them. It's unfortunate, I think, that we don't put things in their cultural context when we read them and understand them. If Genesis is the book of beginnings, then I would think Exodus is the book of adolescence. And what you see here is the beginnings of a people that are special to God. And like many adolescents, they don't see the dangers in some of the things going on in the world. And any good parent, if they're a good parent, will discipline them. They'll train them in order to teach them the warnings and the dangers out there and warn them of the dangers that are out there. And even though a young person may not see or understand why the warning is given, might think mom and dad's just trying to keep them from having fun, it is the case that a loving parent will guide them and discipline them in such a way as to keep them from those pitfalls of life. And so if that discipline doesn't happen, then soon what you find is an individual becomes rebellious as they mature, as they grow, and do not care, not only for themselves, but for others. And if that's allowed to go on and nurtured, then it becomes a callousness with no care whatsoever for anyone or anything around them. And then pretty soon, rebelliousness and callousness becomes a career, and risk becomes a way of life. And then what we have in our physical world is a generation that doesn't recognize Numbers 32:23, and be sure your sin will find you out. And I believe what God began here is the beginning of an adolescent training session, teaching them how they ought to be different, giving them laws I am sure they did not understand in their completeness, and yet laws they were expected to understand and know. And we've been benefited because we are able to look back at this and also look forward and appreciate the big picture, a picture they could not see. And we can understand some of the reasons for some of those laws that God gave that they didn't understand. And yet still, at the same time, they were expected to obey them. God was preparing a special people, a unique people, very similar and very parallel to Christians today. You and I as Christians, in not being born into the family, like born in a certain part of the state or whatever, but or a certain part of the country, but, you know, we have that free moral agency, that choice to become a child of God. But in doing so, we take upon ourselves that commitment to be different. Now, for as much as we like to believe in America that we are unique and we pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, we're independent, such is far from reality. Conformity is the way to go these days. I don't think PC would ever make it, being politically correct would ever make it, if there were not the peer pressure all around us, and sometimes very violent peer pressure, to conform, to be egalitarian, to be pluralistic, you know, to be politically correct. Peer pressure is a very powerful thing. And yet you and I as Christians today, much like the Israelites of old, were told, you're going to be different. And because of what you do in obedience to God, it will make you different. It will be something that is seen. People will know you're different by looking at you. And of course, the first accusation that is hurled at us when we take this kind of position is that, oh, you think you're somebody. Well, you know, I'm not sure that the Israelites were ever subject to that, thinking they were somebody, taking on a Pharisaic attitude, that kind of thing. But I do know this, before that kind of mentality ever started, God dealt with it. Turn with me to Deuteronomy, the 9th chapter, and as we read the first 6 verses of that chapter, God made it very plain at the outset that the product of this special people was not because they were special, but because God made them special in His sight. It was not some intrinsic value that they had as Israelites that made them somebody. It was because God had chosen them. And so we see even in the Old Testament the preponderance of grace, the notion that it's by God's grace that they were in the position they were in. And it wasn't of themselves. It wasn't as though they could take a prideful, boastful nature and say, oh, we're special. No, they were special because God set them apart. And matter of fact, He said, hear, O Israel, thou art to pass over the Jordan this day to go in to possess nations greater and mightier than thyself, cities great and fenced up to heaven. So right off the bat, He's telling them as a fact, you are not as great as the nations that you are fixing to conquer. Okay, so before you begin to think you're somebody, just recognize in reality who you really are. And further, a people and great and tall, the children of the Anakims, that's not the Star Wars guy, this is just a certain bunch of people, Anakims, whom thou knowest and of whom thou hast heard say, who can stand before the children of Anak? So he even gives a particular example of the individuals who were greater than them and they knew it. He's pointing out what they already know. He goes on and says, understand therefore this day that the Lord thy God is He which goeth over before thee as a consuming fire. He shall destroy them. You notice that personal pronoun in reference to deity all the way through this? Who is it that is actually felling the walls of Jericho and doing all of these wondrous things? It certainly wasn't marching around the city. It was God doing all these things, and He's going to destroy them, and He shall bring them down before thy face. So shalt thou drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord hath said unto thee. They had a part to do. Grace always had a reciprocal action in reception. And so He says to them, speak not thou in thine heart. Now, we're not talking about boasting, you know, trash talking, how we're just better than you, that kind of thing. He said, don't even think it. Don't even think it. Don't think for one moment that you're somebody because of my choosing you. He said, don't think in your heart after that the Lord thy God has cast them out from before thee, saying, for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord doth drive them out before thee. Basically saying, this is an act of justice on God's part. These people did not obey commandments, and therefore you are merely a tool in the hands of divine God in taking this land. In God's providence, the way He sees the whole picture, He understood this particular time would come and planned for it. And even though this is the case, they would go in and conquer the land, it was not because of their abilities that they did so. It was God casting them out as an act of judgment upon them. So He said, no, not for thy righteousness or for thine uprightness of heart dost thou go to possess their land, but for the wickedness of these nations the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee, that He may perform the word which the Lord sware unto thy fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is a promise He made, knowing, of course, all future. So He goes on and says in verse 6, and He gives the punchline here. Understand, therefore, that the Lord thy God giveth thee not this good land to possess it for thy righteousness, for thou art a stiff-necked people. And that would come back and bite them later, because certainly God had them pegged. Right off the bat, as we look at the unique commandments that God is giving the children of Israel here in Exodus, let us understand at the outset that what God is giving them is going to help make them a special and unique people. It was not that they were such already. It was not that they intrinsically had that value. It was a value God placed on them. Much like you and I as Christians today are unique and special, not because I'm somebody or you're somebody, but because we have, in acquiescence to God's commands, obeyed Him and become something because of what God has arranged. Let it never be said that we are better intrinsically than anyone. Let no one ever get away of accusing us of being arrogant and overbearing because we demand that we follow what God says. We're saved by grace, brethren. I don't deny that, and I preach it fervently. It does not deny the fact that I have obligations, and it certainly does not make me special or better than anyone else. What it makes me is saved in God's sight. And we need to impress that upon the people out there that are being confused daily about our mentality and our attitude toward those who are without, who are not unique and special in the religious world today like the Christian is. And so we find that basically God says, I'm going to make you different than those around you. And so you can turn to Leviticus 18 and you can see what he tries to do for them to make them unique and special. And this goes along with all of these things that he tells them they're going to do. In Leviticus 18, beginning in verse 24, he tells them just before that of some abominations that we will broach later on in this lesson, hopefully. But you'll notice in Deuteronomy 18, beginning in verse 24, he tells them, defile not ye yourselves in any way of these things. For in all these the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. You see God's justice here. And they were under law of some sort, or they could not have sinned against God in doing these defiling things. And so therefore he goes on, he said, and the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity upon thereof upon it. And the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. Kind of a graphic statement, don't you think? You know, I don't know how anyone can read these kinds of words, understanding their divine origin, understanding God's mentality toward those who innovate, those who change God's clear directives in worship and service, and still propose to do the things that many of our own brethren are experimenting with today. When in a land like this, God says the land, because of their defilement, has vomited them out. You have to really be slow of mind or ignorant not to understand this, folks. I mean, no offense, but it's the fact. You go on in verse 26. He said, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments. You shall not commit any of these abominations. And so the statutes and the judgments have something to do with their uniqueness, but also is a guide as to how they're to conduct themselves. Neither of any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you. There is a code of conduct, even for those that are among you, because you're that unique. For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew not you out also, when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you. Oh, yes, you can fall from grace. It's been that way forever. You can become God's child. You can be special and unique as God's child, and then you can turn away from God and be rejected for it. Free moral agency that we have is critical to understand. We have the option to obey God. We have the option not to obey God. It's our personal choice, something God has divinely instilled within us. And it is the wise choice to maintain faithfulness. So he continues on, for whosoever shall commit any of these abominations, even the souls that commit them shall be cut off from among the people. Therefore shall ye keep mine ordinances, and if ye commit not any of these things, these abominable customs, which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein, I am the Lord your God. There's your punchline. I am the Lord, I have the authority to make these rules. You are different, you are unique, and these concepts that make you unique and different are what will be identifiers for you as God's people. I don't know where ecumenicalism got its toehold in the church. Maybe I'm not old enough to have remembered how it began or started, but that's one of the plagues of the church today. When you read the Old Testament and you see these unique commands that were so different than those all about them, God expected them to obey these commandments, and part of the reason was it would make them different. You and I, Christians, are different than those in the world. Yes, there are similarities. Yes, there are things that those in the religious world out there do very similar to what we do, but one has to ask the question, from what foundation do those activities come from? And why do we do what we do? The plague of the church today, and I do not mean to hurt anyone's feelings, but I believe this to be a fact from what I've observed. The plague of the church today are second generation Christians. Second generation Christians. And I use that term meaning those who are children of faithful Christians. And the reason I make that statement is so many are no less denominational in their religious mentality because they don't know why they are who they are. They do not study the Old Testament. They do not understand the uniqueness of Christian life. And therefore, they are being like their parents and they are becoming Christians like their parents and going to a church of Christ like their parents and have no idea why it is they're unique. Part of the reason we have problems of division in churches of Christ today is because we have not gone back to the book to understand how different we are from every other religion in society, bar none. God's people are unique. We are different. And the very mentality ought to be embedded in us from the very beginning of our baptism and thoroughly matured and developed throughout the entirety of our Christianity. We are not like everyone else. The very desire to be like others was the downfall of Israel. And we'll get to that later, hopefully. My point being, we need to be unique. And so when we look at these laws as we begin in Exodus 21 and 22... look at the uniqueness of these laws. Look at them in the context in which they are used, and it will help us better understand why it is that Israel was called to be very unique. I think it's interesting as we look at Exodus, the 21st chapter, in our beginnings, that right before that, the Decalogue is given, something that has been for years and years thought to be binding upon all, and that's been covered sufficiently in other lectures. I won't go there. But suffice it to say that when we understand that all of this is one law, one big law, these ordinances and this Decalogue are all one big part, nailed to the cross, not only do we not sacrifice kid goats on Saturday, but we also do not keep the Sabbath. And one point I would make strongly with anyone who claims to still follow the Ten Commandments, ask them how far they travel to worship on Saturday. And that will usually solve one of them anyway. The point being, of course, you can only travel a certain distance, and most of us in this highly technologically developed society travel much further than that when we go and worship somewhere. And so there are a lot of differences between this law and what we have today. But that does not remove the fact that it is still very useful to us in understanding God's unique plan for a unique people. And so let's look at some of the issues that come up. And as I said before, we're going to chase rabbits and go every which way because none of these mesh together well. And I think it's ironic, right to begin with, in chapter 21, that he begins with some discussion about slavery. Do you find that ironic? Here we have, well, it's the old deal. You know, you can take the slaves out of slavery, but you can't take the slavery out of the slaves. And maybe that was the case. Maybe that was why this is predominant, why this is maybe the first thing that we deal with as an issue. Possibility here, because they were slaves, and what they had as a mentality concerning slaves was nothing more than what they grew up with, what they were born into. What they had as a notion about how you treated slaves is how they were treated. And so God, at the very beginning, at the very outset of some of these laws, begins to tell them, you're unique and different. You will treat slaves differently than what you've experienced. And before we become too condemning of their loving the slavery mentality. I mean, we can remember as during their travels, you know, they look back to the flesh pots of Egypt and, you know, oh, it was so much better then. It's amazing how we forget things. Our memory gets clouded and we remember things differently than they really are. And certainly they were no exception, traveling out there seemingly desolate and out in the middle of nowhere. And then looking back to the flesh pots of Egypt, not remembering the slavery that was co-joined with it and the problems that went with it. Before we get too condemning about that, look at Romans, the 6th chapter, just briefly. Because it is the case we as preachers have considerable bit of job security, I think, because of this very situation. Is it amazing that as Christians, we, you and I, have been freed from slavery? 16th verse there talks about the fact that who we serve is who we are slave to. And yet we look at the fact that in Christ, we've been delivered from that slavery. We've got a freedom now that is in Christ, a liberty in Christ that we didn't have before. We have a connection and a relationship with the Father versus taskmaster. We are freed from this slavery. And yet, why is Paul writing this 6th chapter of Romans? To impress upon them the fact that you're not slaves anymore. Change your mentality. What is it in verse 24, I think, that he goes back and says, what was it in verse 21, I'm sorry. What was it in your past life, the fruits of the things that you did in this slavery that you're all proud of now, that is so desirable that makes you want to go back to it? It's amazing that we so quickly forget the consequences of sin that we have to deal with every day. The fact that if we do not live right, there are consequences, and we'll get to that later, hopefully. The notion that we're going to be responsible someday. Maybe we can get away with it for a little while, but some point in time, we're going to reap what we sow. And yet we look at the slavery that we have come out of. The ability to approach the Father and be forgiven on a constant basis. The beauty of the hope that instills us, fills us with the bravery and the courage that we need to deal with problems in life, the lack of fear that we can have as Christians. Why in the world would we want to go back to that slavery of a sinful life? And yet preachers, since preachers began, have been trying to encourage people to recognize the slavery of sin and the freedom that is in Christ Jesus. Indeed, we have job security. So before we're too rough on the Israelites for not removing that slavery mentality, understanding they grew up in it and lived in it, and that was their life, before we're too critical, let's understand in its context that these people were dealing with some baggage here. They had a lot of baggage to get rid of, and in God's patience, I'm sure he understood that and was incredibly long-suffering. And so he begins talking about, first of all, a Hebrew slave. Elsewhere, we talk about slaves taken from heathens. But right off the bat, we've got instructions about Hebrew slaves. And I think it's interesting that when we look at the Hebrew slave, the Hebrew servant, we have to be very careful about how we identify who or what slavery is. It's interesting how egocentric we are. We view everything from the American perspective or from the Texan perspective or whatever the case may be. But certainly we have that problem with seeing slave or this servant in a particular light. And some of it is very strongly affected by our country's history and our history with slavery. But we need to put it in its context. If you understand slavery from the biblical perspective, servanthood, those kinds of things, there is a range that goes from everything to almost like a son, Abraham's servant Eliezer, all the way to some very rigorous, hard, vigorous kinds of servitude that people were found in. And so there's a broad spectrum that is covered when you use these terms. So you have to be careful and look at the context and see what we're talking about when we talk about a Hebrew slave. In this particular context, we're talking about an individual who is a slave and sometimes by their own choice. Now, sometimes it's not by their choice. We'll look at that. But sometimes it's by their own choice. And while I don't envision, you know, in verse 6, the notion of choosing to serve a master and the sign of it being having his ear bored through with an awl, put your ear up against the door, I don't see the delicate little jewelry that people wear today. Although that trend is changing, I've seen some sports guys, some athletes that have rocks the size of softball in their ear. I'm just waiting for them to put the plates in their lips. But anyway, I don't see that in this particular text, but I do understand that what it was is a signification of someone who chose to be a servant. Now, that kind of puts a little light or casts a little light on the notion of servanthood, slavery. You're not talking about some of the things that occurred basically in the United States some time ago. We're not talking about some of the conflict and controversy that arose during the, what was it that Tyler said, war between the states? Or no, that wasn't it. It was the War of Northern Aggression. Yeah, that was it. A little pejorative maybe from a perspective. And I don't want to take sides, of course, but the distinction between those two types of servanthood contrasts, and it's almost at opposite ends of the pole. Abraham particularly had servants and was rich with servants. The servants were very happy to be with him and pleased to be with him, and one was in line to inherit had Abraham not had that child of promise. So you can see the treatment of servants is quite different. However, you do have the other extreme, and it was not a justifiable type extreme. When you look at Genesis 34, 28, and 29, the ugly rape incident of Dinah and the spoils of conquest mentality when you go in and kill all the male servants and bring out your slaves, basically. So you have both kinds of slavery that are involved back there. But when you talk about a Hebrew servant, you'll notice immediately from the difference between 22 verse 2 and 22, verse 16, that there is a stark contrast made between man-stealing and the slavery or servanthood that was common during that day. Man-stealing was a whole different animal. And certainly that's what we in the United States, prior to our war between the states, were involved in. And there's a very big difference between the two. And I really shudder when people go back to the Old Testament, jerk these kinds of contexts out of context, and begin to try to justify slavery. However, I understand the predicament that you could see people get into in something like the war between the states, where Garfield is on one side and Larimore is on another, one in gray, one in blue. And how would you, maybe this is a question that Tyler could have expounded upon more when you talk about the war between the states. How would you react when someone comes in and conscripts you for service in a military institute where you're shooting across the line at a brother? And that brings up a lot of difficulties. Nevertheless, one of the key issues in that conflict had to do with slavery. The notion of whether or not men are free or not free. And I go into that to some degree in the manuscript. I would recommend you to it. But nevertheless, what we do need to do is draw the distinction between man-stealing and this servanthood, and also understand that as far as slavery is concerned, there were a lot more or a lot different notions or reasons for slavery during this period of time. How is it then that a Hebrew would find himself in indentured servitude in this particular case? Well, there's a couple of reasons mentioned. One in Exodus 22 and 3, and that's when you commit a crime. It's a wonderful thing. We have a problem in our justice system, and I think it's our perspective. I don't think we understand God's laws concerning justice and how justice should be meted out. Somebody comes into my home, and I have opportunity to defend myself, and I pop him with a .357, which I'll warn you now will happen if you're not invited and you come in at 3 in the morning. You're liable to get shot. I have the right to defend my home. And with no remorse, I would defend my family and my home. And certainly in the Bible, that was the case. However, if it was the case that someone stole, and in the process of stealing, they were caught with the goods, and they could not repay what was required of them, then they repaid with their life in servitude. It's a very effective deterrent, let alone very productive. Instead of affording them cable TV, a weight room, and a law library to jam up our law systems, I think that would be a real great answer to some of our justice problems today. Of course, I have some pretty pointed views on that. We'll get to that capital punishment in a minute. The other one, a reason for slavery, might be debt. Debt, just plain old debt. Oh, we don't have time to cover that one in our society. Plastic rules, you know. Money just doesn't exist hardly anymore. And we have gotten to a point in our society where buy now, pay later, maybe, is the standard. The idea is we can get ourselves socked into debt so deeply that we can't possibly get out of it and just back off, as my son used to say on certain occasions. Oh, my bad. As though that makes everything go away. Oh, no, that's not the case. If I owe it, I pay it. And in the Old Testament, if you weren't able to pay it, then you were an indentured servant until such time as you paid it off. In fact, that habit, that kind of contextual thing, went all the way into Matthew 18. Matthew, where Jesus talks about the fact that in that parable, that servant that couldn't pay his debt and was ironically thrown into prison until he could pay the debt. Now, how he could pay the debt in prison, I don't know. I don't know how that worked exactly. But nevertheless, he was held accountable for what he charged up. And so in the Old Testament, where they didn't have Greenspan tinkering with the numbers so that we have a little better economy, and where we didn't have credit bureaus that get us out of our problem debt, where, you know, they try to cut up our cards, although you get more immediately, there was nothing like that in this society. And so slavery very often was the case of I've run up a bill or I've gotten myself into a debt problem and I have to pay it off. And so therefore, the slavery occurred. However, what we do want to learn from this, particularly concerning slavery, is that in Old Testament, in New Testament examples, we find slavery existent, and the fact that is that God did mandate certain rules that covered this slavery. That is not to say that he approves of all slavery. And there are many things upon which God mandated certain conducts and activities that he did not approve of particularly. Marriage, divorce, remarriage is one particular example of that. In Matthew 19, Jesus hearkened back to the beginning and said, it was the hardness of your hearts, fellas, that God made some exceptions and he mandated and he designed certain ways in which we should conduct ourselves. But if you go back to the beginning, as Jesus said, this is the way it's supposed to have been done, and this is the way you should have been doing it, and that's the way it is now. And so very often, God, in his patience and in his long-suffering, would allow for certain things, although he was not in complete approval of them. So before we jump back to the Old Testament and justify slavery, let's be sure we put it into context. The second issue that we might look at has to do with violence against humanity and the notion that humanity, and this is the foundation of these laws, is that humanity is unique. Humanity is different than all of the rest of creation. It's unfortunate that in our society a baby seal has precedent over the unborn. It's disgusting and repugnant and inconsistent that we would go out and picket, and I'm not nearly done, Cliff, picket and cry out against the environmental atrocities, as it is put, and yet at the same time take peace by peace, children from the womb. That is horrid. In our society, I do believe someday we'll pay for it. The violence against humanity included things such as capital punishment and the gross stupidity and ignorance of anybody who thinks that socially approved murder has just not read their Bible or are not reasonable. As a matter of fact, because life is in the blood, in Genesis 9:6, we're told that when man sheds blood, then by man his blood shall be shed, which tells us by implication there is a social responsibility to give a value to life. Those who are against capital punishment, whether they realize it or not, are against human value. That's what it boils down to. Let me rush through towards the end of this. There are laws about accountability that we don't go into too much. Suffice it to say that we live in a country where we are not accountable for what we do or what we say, and we have the lawyers to prove it. And I mean no offense to any lawyers. We need our lawyers that are good ones. But we have enough lawyers in this country that a few less would not be missed. No offense intended. But it is a fact that we have a country where if I do anything, I can get me a lawyer that makes me the exception to the rule. Run a stop sign, run over somebody, whatever the case may be, if I have enough money and if I have enough standing and influence, I can find a lawyer that will get me off because I'm the exception to the rule. In the Old Testament, God dealt with it much differently. Very often, as a matter of fact, the individuals involved in or witnessing in that crime were involved in its punishment. Violent crimes, which include abortion, again, we don't have time to go into that. Laws of accountability, laws about property, and the idea of punitive damage. I mean, notice throughout the two chapters where you have someone who steals or who does something detrimental to someone else's property, they repay, and it's with the best, Exodus 22:5, or double, Exodus 22:9. Oh, it's not just enough to say, oh, I broke yours, here's mine. No, you do a little bit better than that because there's some trauma that goes along with that. There is an encroachment upon someone else's rights that went along with that, and that too needs to be addressed. Also, finally, and the one that I want to get to before I got too far is found in Leviticus 18:21 through 23. It amazes me that our country is so mindless in its pursuit of personal pleasure. When you see individuals who are trying to promote the notion of homosexuality, totally disregarding Leviticus 18, here in three verses, you find in the verse 21, Leviticus 18:21, and thou shalt not let any of thy seed pass through the fire of Moloch, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God, I am the Lord. To go into the details of Moloch would just make you sick at how they would fry children alive, small infants alive in the hands of a burning, fiery idol. Though that kind of thing was repugnant. If you skip down to verse 23, this one here is almost too gross to read in a public way. But neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith, neither shalt any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereunto. It is confused. It's horrible to even perceive or conceive of something like that. And yet the people of this land were doing those things. What do you find right in the middle of those two horrendous, abominable actions? Homosexuality. And it very well may be that I go to prison, as someone has said here before, because I stand up from the pulpit or in the public forum and tell people, I love you, I hate your homosexuality. It is wrong, it is sin, it's abominable, look at the company it keeps. We are to be a holy people. And therefore, we are different and we are unique. And folks, we are becoming more and more different and unique. And folks, it's time to grow a spine. It's time to have the courage to stand up and say, regardless of what you think you can do to me, I'm going to speak the truth. And the truth is, homosexuality is sin. It is wrong. God has always viewed it as abominable. And we ought not to have any part of it. Neither should we support it in any way, shape, or form. It is amazing, in conclusion, that such plain speech is used in these two chapters, so many issues that are dealt with, so easy to understand that Israel would ultimately fail. And we see the long downsliding down that slippery slope from Joshua's generation and just past him into Judges, where they oscillated back and forth, into the kings, where they chose a human leader instead of God, to a divided kingdom, and the ultimate final result of captivity, all because after a long litany of things that Hosea mentioned, their problem was, Hosea 7:8, put this down in your book, Ephraim hath mixed himself among the people. That's a problem. We are unique, we are pure, we are different than anybody in society. The very notion of our mixing ourselves with anybody in our culture, in the religious organizations of this time, is repugnant in God's sight. We ought not to have any part of it. Thank you very much.